Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition, available April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a TVO podcast.
Hi, I'm Colin Ellis, and you're listening to On Docs, a podcast about documentaries and the stories they tell. And today I'm joined by our producer, Matthew O'Mara, who's here to talk about a little film called High Score with me. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Colin. How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. How's your day going?
Ah, pretty good. You know, it's a bright, nice early morning, and I'm still in my pajamas recording a podcast, so that's cool.
Podcaster's dream, man.
Yeah.
So, what are we talking about today?
We're talking about High Score, which is Netflix's docuseries about video game history. And it's a 6-part series that goes from, you know, the start of video gaming as a whole, like talking about the really, really, really old consoles. And it goes as far as talking about online gaming. And that's a series.
Long before the internet, a handful of visionaries reimagine the world.
We felt that we were creating a world-changing technology.
I had no idea what to expect.
Pac-Man is so cute. It
is. It's so cute.
I don't know if you were a huge gamer when you were growing up. I was pretty much into Super Nintendo, Game Boy, that sort of thing. What about you?
Oh, I mean, I have two older brothers, and they are super into games, and, like, just by default, I was always, like, player, I guess, 3 on most games that we had, and not even player 2. But yeah, I mean, I grew up playing games, and I still play a lot. I even wrote about games when I first started out in my career in journalism. My console, pathway in life was starting out with a Nintendo Entertainment System, going to get a Sega Genesis, then the Nintendo 64, and then a GameCube, and then a Wii, and then at that point, me and my brothers all had jobs, so we just bought everything else. So, yeah.
Okay, so you're officially a gaming expert then?
Yeah, I'd say so, pretty much. Yeah, definitely.
Well, this is a little different episode for us because I'm actually not the one doing the interview today. It's going to be you. So mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us who's coming on the show?
Yeah, I spoke with Kashana Gray, who's an assistant professor in gender and women's studies and communications at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And she's written about online communities, gaming culture, and black gamers on streaming platforms like Twitch. I wanted to speak to an expert who could give me a historian's perspective. I also want a set of eyes who could provide a bit of a critique of the series because, you know, the series is, you know, telling the history of the early, you know, beginnings of video games. And it does have these little asides where they talk about some of these hidden figures in gaming culture and history. But Kashana had actually been on another podcast where she talked about who she thought were the hidden figures in gaming. So I really want to tap into that and see who, you know, she thought may have needed to have been included in this series, maybe where parts of the series had kind of fallen flat, and just her thoughts on it as a whole.
Yeah, well, it was a really good conversation, so maybe we should get to it, eh?
Yeah, let's get to it. Here's our conversation with Dr. Kashana Gray. Kashana Gray, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you so much for taking time out to chat about things that I love.
Well, I appreciate you coming onto the show during this busy time while you're teaching. Well, let's get into it. We're going to be talking a bit about Netflix's High Score. So what did you think of it?
So, you know, there are multiple ways that I engage things, right? So just mm-hmm. on the face of it, just the sheer entertainment value of it, learning the history of like video games, I absolutely loved it. Amazing, you know, and I always, you know, it's really interesting, especially, you know, especially when you're so immersed in a culture, you know, you never think about like mm-hmm. the behind the scenes things that are happening and these cool, innovative people who are doing these things that we love. And so I love that, you know, they're telling these stories and, you know, like, you know, I was a kid right there when, I wasn't much of like an Atari kid or even Nintendo, you know, Sega and right. Sonic, you know, are near and dear to my heart because of, you know, just the generation that I am in gaming. So I love that. And especially another thing that I love is that, you know, we can honor these folks like while they're still here, like all these innovative people who've given us like video games are, you know, for the most part still around, and we can like let them know how much we love and appreciate the thing that they gave us. So I absolutely enjoyed it. Absolutely.
I mean, it's not like we're talking about Renaissance painting where most of the artists are now gone. So
right?
We can still talk to you. We're still living the history, which is a bit different for this.
Absolutely. And there's also like this thing that, you know, like in cultures that happens where, you know, we don't really appreciate them or value them until like, you know, they've passed or gone and they're like, oh, look at all this amazing music that they had. Look at all this stuff, you know. So I love that folks can see like in real time just how much like we really value and appreciate, you know, these cultural products.
So let's get into just a bit of a short recap of the series for our listeners out there. And here's a bit of what they covered. They talked about arcades. They talked about Nintendo's role in the video gaming world, role-playing games, RPGs, as they're called, sports games and PC gaming. You know, but, you know, as a historian, as a person who studies video games, you know, is there anything that you wish that they had included in the series?
Yeah, so I want to chat a little bit about, you know, like what was there, right? So something, mm-hmm. you know, from all these, you know, it's been like a few years. I feel like every year there's like a new like documentary, right? So this is like a new genre, you know, the video game documentary. I love that they, you know, included, you know, like tabletop Dungeons and Dragons. You know, I love that they incorporated, you know, those kinds of conversations into the conversation around gaming as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it opened up like the conversation to be like a little bit more broad. So it's not just like, oh, like a video game. It's also like, you know, play and leisure and creating these immersive worlds, you know, and then also with like just the imagination. Like, you know, I love that, you know, they talked about just like, I remember, I can't remember his name. He was at the Nintendo guy that kept walking into the room with the cigarette, like, you know,
Shigeru Miyamoto.
Yeah. I like just to see like the thought process, you know, like just what went on, like in the behind the scenes of people, you know, coming up with these fantastic things. And I love that, you know, they put like, you know, you have the visionary, the person that has these big ideas that are pushing the boundaries, also with the people that can make it happen, you know? So mm-hmm. I really loved, you know, that relationship. I'm sure these were tough relationships to have, you know, I'm sure these were like, you know, they weren't so, you know, we're painting the like there was like nice and pretty and all fun and happy, everybody's having a good time, you know, but I'm sure that, you know, these were strained relationships, you know, especially when I just can't even imagine the strained relationship was the folks that created Doom, and then they put out the press release, and then, you know, they put themselves under that time constraint, like to do that, to give us like our first like online multiplayer like engagement, like I couldn't imagine just how tough it probably got in like that space. So, you know, so I want to make sure, you know, just to like, you know, acknowledge just the things that are there, and I love that we were able to put like the human side behind it. We were mm-hmm. able to you know, see that these humans who just wanted to create like cool things. I love that we were able to see that they gave us some of that background nuance, you know, to how tough and how complex it was.
For the first time, you can play in a high-speed 3D world where you're blowing your friends apart.
God damn it.
It's really fun to play against each other in deathmatch. And it influenced everybody in wanting to make games.
One thing that Netflix's High Score really did was is they seem to have uncovered a lot of hidden figures in, you know, gaming history. We're talking about, you know, people like, I don't know, those people who are working in the Nintendo helpline. I mean, talking about
yes.
the guy. Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing, you know, story that they're talking about, where, you know, kids used to be able to call in to get hints and tips for, you know, playing games. But I mean, in 2018, you were at Gaming for Everyone, and you're up on stage talking for a podcast, and you had mentioned that you want developers and players to know about these hidden figures in gaming. I was wondering, who were you talking about?
One of the things that I was, we don't know. So I was engaged in a conversation with somebody. We were trying to figure out who like the first Black game developer was. And, mm-hmm. you know, there are some people who think that, you know, they think they were the first, like, so all of a sudden, you know, we just have like some really dope, like Black folks, you know, who are just in this space. And we don't know like what the origin story is, you know, so we've got like the story, of course, of the amazing, the Black man that gave us like the cartridge, right? You know, like putting like the cartridge, putting the game, like stored in a cartridge and being able to play like across platforms. And then, you know, we've got, oh, even the guy, I was really excited, like to see the story of the Black man who basically put Black athletes on the sports games, right?
Yeah, it was Gordon Bellamy.
Yeah, Gordon. I remember meeting Gordon like at that event that you're talking about. So I was glad to like see those, but I just felt as I was watching that those stories were so short and not they weren't at a level where I felt like they were engaging in an in-depth level as some of the other stories were engaged. You know, like to me, it felt like, okay, well, we have to just pay homage to, like, you know, these Black folks. But I just don't even feel like their stories were really, like, immersed in, like, the whole narrative. They were like, okay, so here's, like, so imagine, like, the story that High Scores is telling is, like, a line on, like, a linear story, you know, on a path. And then they were like, and then they had to, like, stop. And like, oh, well, maybe we should talk about, you know, this trans woman. Oh, man, well, they did a great job with her story. You know, I was glad to see that. I was very, you know, glad that they acknowledged. I can't remember her name.
Rebecca Heineman.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So I didn't feel like that was like an afterthought. You know, I felt like that they really were, you know, incorporated her story in a meaningful way. But when it got to like the Black stories, I feel like, first off, I think we only had two Black stories, right?
Something that you talked about during that 2018 fireside chat is that, you know, when video games were kind of on the decline after the, you know, arcade boom and bust, and, you know, video games were kind of like a up in the air kind of thing. It's like, is this going to become a medium? Is this just going to fizzle into nothing? You were talked about in the fireside chat that it wasn't, you know, the white developers that really helped video games come back. It was actually
black and brown kids
mm-hmm. playing in, you know, arcades. Could you just tell me a bit more about that story?
Absolutely. So I think in an era where, you know, arcades were, you know, on the decline, you know, the console game in like the household, you know, it didn't reach like the level that a lot of these execs thought it would reach. But the thing is that, you know, while, you know, the arcades, you know, that first decline, the first wave of arcades, you know, like was on the decline, right? Mm-hmm. These arcades, they were cheap. And a lot of people were buying them up, right? So a lot of places that were buying them up were like these bodegas and these corner stores. So these people were buying the arcades and bringing those arcades into like the urban centers, right? Into like a lot of these like poor, you know, Black and brown like neighborhoods. And so what this showed was that there is a particular demographic of folks like who are still interested in this and who will still participate. So it was basically Black and Latino youth in like these large urban centers that basically kept the console afloat, or kept arcades afloat, and thus kept the console afloat, right? Where people were like, well, there's still like a viable market here. But the problem is that the industry continues to market towards like this aspirational population, they want, you know, these white teen adolescents like to be, you know, their target demographic. And they continue to ignore like the folks who are there and who are present, right? You know, so when you go in, like if you can hear, even I love like hearing like, you know, these old rappers' story. Chris Rock has a story. Like all of these dope Black folks have these stories about how they spent all their, you know, all these quarters, you know, in these corner stores, like on these arcades, like playing these arcades and like playing these things. So, you know, that wasn't even featured. I got really excited when they started talking about arcades. I'm like, you have to talk about, you know, the arcade that's like the arcades in the hood, you know, and they didn't. And I think that was like it was such a huge miss, right? Right. So it's Anna Everett's work. Anna Everett, you know, she talked about, you know, those early days of like, you know, like technology and like, you know, Black neighborhoods, and you know how you know Black folks have always been like a savvy, innovative like population of folks who have always used it, but we just ignore it because think about the time, you know, that maybe Black folks were like using like these arcades, you know, they couldn't go to the mall, you know, because think about, you know, even how we like police Black bodies. So think about even like in the city of Chicago, right? So, you know, you may have had arcades like in the mall, but you couldn't just have like a group of young Black boys just in that space being loud and being, you know, too aggressive, like in the eyes, like the police would be called. So, you know, a lot of like Black and brown youth weren't even able to take part of like that first wave of the arcades. It was only when, you know, they went on the decline and, you know, a lot of these stores could purchase them like for a cheaper price that they were even able to like really like take part. And, you know, we've lost that history. That's some hidden history, but it's there if we just kind of like put it together. You know, we hear, you know, about a lot of these entertainers that talk about, you know, they fell in love with, you know, like Street Fighter, you know, and they fell in love, you know, with these different kinds of games, like in the arcade, like at the corner store, the arcade that's in their corner store.
Something I want to talk a bit about was we had mentioned Gordon Bellamy, and one thing about him that we don't really talk about, or they didn't get into in the documentary series, is he was actually a pretty high up executive in the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA, And in 2019, you know, the IGDA reported that a majority of game developers are white. It's something like 80% of them are white, and, you know, only 2% of them are black. And you had also mentioned previously a 2015 Pew study, and I believe that found something like, a really high percentage. There was a higher percentage of black teenagers who play games more than white teenagers who play games. So I guess my question is, you know, why doesn't the industry reflect their audience, like, at all?
Think about the ways that industries would have to contort if they're like, all of a sudden, oh, well, we have girls that play this game, so we have to create a game for girls. Like, what is that going to look like? Girls like this or girls like that? So the industry can't even fathom that the thing that they're already creating and putting out into the world are things that we love too. We love these things. Girls play those things. Like, and so there was like a moment even in the game where they had to like figure out what girls are playing. We got to create Miss Pac-Man, you know, for the girl. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just silly, you know, that they just had to like create like Pac-Man because they're like, well, girls don't want to shoot. Well, yeah, we do. We've been shooting. We're doing it. We've been doing that, you know? And so I think it's one of those things where the industry, you know, will just lose its collective mind and will get its collective panties in a bunch, you know, if they have to like think about, because in their mind, they're like, well, this is a different audience, we have to target and market to them like differently, right? And so that's just talking about like the consumer, right? But with the people who are like behind the scenes, that's a different conversation altogether. So when you think about the people who are there, right, there are traditional pathways of how like folks like end up like in these development and design like kind of jobs and positions, right? A traditional pathway, of course, you know, is like, you know, computer science, right? Another pathway, you know, could be like engineering, you know, so folks are in these like heavy STEM fields, like, you know, the people who are producing these things are in these heavy STEM fields. Now, the last time I checked, MIT was not just admitting black students like en masse, right? The last time I checked, you know, Google was not admitting like, you know, black interns en masse, right? So we have like a traditional pipeline. Now there is like research in STEM. I remember a friend of mine, Sharuni Ratnabalasuriar, she did her dissertation work, or she did some of her work on like the leaky pipe. And it's the leaky pipe in STEM is where we lose like women and girls. It's like where we lose like folks of color. It's where we lose like these folks who are not like the part of like the traditional target audience, right? And then culturally is where we lose a lot of them, because they're like, okay, well, this culture doesn't really fit me. It's a lot of dude bros, you know. It's a lot of like, you know, there's this white Western culture that is like, you know, like it's running the show here, right? And then we also have to think, you know, when they think about like incorporate like designing technology for like different populations, you know, there's all kinds of like sexism that could be inherent in that. So when people are like, oh, we got to design games for girls, well, give them Barbie and pink and purple, you know, that's right. Sexism, you know, people have to like be there and like exist like within that moment. And so it's already because these gatekeepers, you know, and a lot of time it's networks too, so people rely on their existing networks to make these connections with other folks. So think about even the earliest companies, the earliest startups, the earliest tech startups. It was people that they knew. So it was their friend. Oh, my friend. And their friends are white, you know? So that, and then they, when they want to build their teams and expand their teams, they're going based on what their network that is growing is. And it's still heavily white and male, you know, secondarily like East Asian. So we have to like, you know, contend with the fact that these industries look the way they look because people don't have diverse networks. People don't know a lot of diverse people. And then people go to programs like in computer science programs. I think we had like the numbers that, you know, like showed that there aren't that many women, there aren't that many underrepresented like minorities like in those spaces as well. And so if these companies are relying on, you know, those populations to fill the seats when they have jobs, you know, then all of a sudden you're like cutting out a huge chunk of the of possible applicants, right? So they're also in that the gatekeeping process. You know, folks are creating and designing these job ads with particular parameters. They're getting these parameters of like, okay, they want somebody that went to like a top school. Okay, did you go to Stanford? Did you go to MIT? You know, did you do your internship at like, you know, a big company or like a, you know, so think about like, you know, that person who went to like did the computer science degree at Howard University or Tennessee State or Kentucky State, you know, who went to like a HBCU, right? That's not a traditional traditional pathway. So then they might ignore, you know, those folks because they're like, well, are those programs rigorous enough? So they're and they throw in like language like that, but that's also racially coded, you know, because you're like, okay, it's not rigorous enough because it's at this HBCU. So this HBCU is diminished because, you know, we don't know the professors that are there. We don't know the folks who are there. And it's not a part of like our traditional network. So that's how you're able to sustain white supremacy. That's how you're able to sustain these unequal like structures like along the lines of like race, right? Yeah. So then when you're giving advice to somebody of like, okay, what do you need to do? What's the pathway? You know, let me say something else I get mad at.
Sure.
Gaming culture praising college dropouts.
Yeah, that's a big part of high score too. They talk about so many examples of people saying like, oh well, you know, we made these illegal upgrade packs, we got sued for it, and we quit university because we were making so much money. So
do you know if that was Jose and Jamal, they would be under the jail right now if they did the same thing, right? You know, so that's why, you know, I had to pause and like take a moment because I was really going to stop the high school. You were the one. If it wasn't for this podcast, I would have stopped high school like a long time ago because I saw the story they was going to tell. You know, like I said, I loved it. I want to love it. But I was so bothered by so many of those things. But I had started this thread on Twitter where I was asking folks about, you know, what's the pathway to get into game design and game development, right? Those stories really, the background of a person like really mattered, right? So I had like so many people saying that the way to get there, you have to go to like the top schools and the top programs. So I have so many other people who are like, okay, that traditional pathway just isn't going to work for like black and brown folks. So there was some, you know, a really beautiful thread of where somebody said, hey, you could teach yourself these skills. I taught myself this. And because there's somebody who has spent so much money on all these degrees, like they were the perfect candidate and they still have struggled to be able to get their foot into the door, you know, because they just, I don't know, like, and they don't want to say it's racism, you know, but there's just, we still have to just accept that there are all these exclusionary practices and these entities just don't want women and people of color to be a part of those communities, right?
You know, our audience for On Docs is largely people who watch documentaries. So they might not be, you know, the biggest video game players in the world. But if you could recommend for them to, you know, even take a look at a trailer of a game or play a game, is there a game that you would recommend that they take a look at that kind of represents, you know, the sort of aspirational game of the future of what game development should look like or will look like?
Oh my gosh, Matthew, that's a fantastic question. Oh my gosh. That's a tough question. Mm-hmm. Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry.
Why is that?
Is one, the downloadable content for that. That featured Adewale.
Mm-hmm.
Adewale, and it tells basically, it's a slave narrative, right? You know, so folks have to be ready for that. Not everybody might can consume like a slave narrative. I would want folks to start with the cinematic trailer of Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry. You know, it's a live action cinematic trailer, and that transitions into like the animation, you know, like the in-game kind of content. But it follows the story of basically, you know, this young black boy who's taken from his mother. You know, he's sold into slavery. And then basically he spends, you know, his time trying to dismantle this institution that took him away from his mom. He single-handedly like takes down slavery in this island in Haiti. I believe, you know, the setting is Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I like about this game is that it forces the user to have to like grapple with a couple things, right? So for instance, we don't often see games that feature all black casts, right? So they're basically just black bodies everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it has, you know, like a few, you know, of course, like the slave handlers and the slave masters and, you know, the plantation owners, you know, it's a sprinkle of like white folks, right? But it's like one of those narratives where you have to play as like the black man. And then you see like just this level of violence that he just wreaks upon this island against like whiteness, mm-hmm. right? And so I think it's like a Django effect. So if folks have seen like Django, like they can like imagine, you know, like this game is like if Django was a video game, this would be it, right? And then, you know, the game that I would want folks to then play afterwards would be So start with Assassin's Creed, Free to mm-hmm. Cry. Go to GTA. So you have to then, we want somebody to play GTA. Now, I want them to play GTA, not because it has any particular, like, cultural value. It does. But there are some things that are happening in, like, GTA. And it's the one, I would want them to play the one, the CJ from San Andreas. Yeah. The San Andreas. I would want them to play that one. Because this game, it opens up, hopefully I'm not conflating Grand Theft Auto, but I believe it's where it opened up. CJ's being released from jail, and then basically Tenpenny, you know, comes, you know, like, you know, Tenpenny, Samuel Jackson's character, is like the epitome of, like, police overuse and abuse of power, police brutality, right? You know, so it says, okay, you're free, but we control you. We still own you, right? So it immediately, like lets us know that, okay, maybe black men might not ever escape from this institutional prison that they're in. Once they're in, they're always in, and they're always locked in, right? And so, and then, you know, it follows, and then it takes us, you know, to his home. You know, he lives in a poor neighborhood. You know, he's living, like, in the ghetto, right? So I think that it's important that would be, like, the next step to see, okay, once the institution of slavery ended, then here we are. We've got these folks who are, like, relegated to these ghettos, right? And so I would want people to, like, think about, okay, how did we get from, like, okay, slavery ended, these black folks are free, but then are they really free? So and then the next game that I would want, like, people to, like, engage in and grapple with would be Watch Dogs 2. Where you see these, you know, this amazing, you know, Marcus, mm-hmm. you know, doing this amazing thing, like, hacking, you know, the city, using these tools at his disposal. You know, I feel like I would want that to be that next, because then it shows, like, here's maybe, like, a potential solution to, like, the problem. Like, not saying that technology will solve it, but, like, if you're equipped with the tools, then maybe you can improve, like, the livelihoods, and you can improve the conditions mm-hmm. of some people somewhere, right? You know, so I would want, you know, folks to maybe, like, play those. And then also, so I would want people to either pick either, you know, Watch Dogs yeah. 2 or Mafia 3,
oh, okay.
where you could be yeah. like, where you could be like, okay, you can be tech solution oriented. We can solve our problems with tech, or we'll just go and shoot and kill everybody. We'll take everybody down. So I feel like, you know, that would be, I don't know if I would want them to play both of them. I would want them to decide, okay, kind of like a choose your own adventure. Like, after you've played, okay, Freedom Cry, and then you play GTA, and then we're going to do something about it. Is tech going to be the thing that you do, or, like, a full on revolution of burning everything down? Is that going to be, like, the path that you go? So that would be what I would want people to then to play.
Okay, OnDocs listeners, you got some homework to do. Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry, and then GTA San Andreas, Watch Dogs 2, or Mafia 3. I mean, that's a great list of games.
Yes.
So, that's perfect.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Kashana Gray, thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate you speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. Y'all take care.
And that's the podcast. High Score is streaming now on Netflix. If you liked what you heard, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and better yet, tell a friend. If you want to get in touch, you can write to us at ondocs@tvo.org, and you can follow me on Twitter at ColinEllis81. Thanks to producer and editor Matthew O'Mara, production support coordinators Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell, series producer Katie O'Connor, and executive producer for digital Laurie Few. We'll catch you at the next screening.